This is People's Tribune Radio. I'm Kenny Shook.
The values of capitalism are such that the individual first, etc., etc., at the expense of the community. And so what cooperative society basically means is the relationship between community and individual, and the community to advance the interests of the individual, and the individual to advance the interests of the community, and one without the other cannot exist really in any healthy, meaningful way.
People's Tribune Radio is brought to you by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League also publishes the newspaper People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. Ordering and contact information will be provided later on in the program. Our guest is a professor at the University of Hawaii. He is author of Lebanon, Dynamics of Conflict, as well as many articles on Arab Americans, Middle East politics, and Hawaii's political economy. Dr. Ibrahim Ayude writes and lectures about a variety of topics, from youth and the struggle of the Palestinian people to the current politics surrounding the peace movement in the United States. Correspondents Tony Zaragoza and Jesus Estrada interview Dr. Ayude on KZUU's Community Forum Radio. We begin with Jesus Estrada, speaking with Dr. Ayude about an article that was posted on the League of Revolutionaries website.
In your piece, Holy Month on Holy Occupation, you were talking about how the occupation in Iraq is affecting Jordan. Could you maybe speak about that a little more?
Yeah, that's one of the things I was mentioning in general, but more specifically is that before the Second Gulf War, which started in 1991, the Bush 1 war against Iraq, the Jordanian economy relied heavily on trade with Iraq, like up to 50% of Jordanian trade was with Iraq. So with Iraq, the economy shattered after the Second Gulf War. I say the Second Gulf War because the First Gulf War is between Iran and Iraq, yeah, and so this is the Second Gulf War. The economy was shattered, and so because of the sanctions that the U.S. Through the U.N. imposed on Iraq, there wasn't much in that kind of trade as used to be. And now with the occupation, that situation is exacerbated, and although there is little kind of trade going, but there's nothing to write home about, and therefore affected seriously in a negative way the Jordanian economy. That on one hand, plus the other thing is that the uprising in Palestine against Israeli occupation also put more strain and stress on the Jordanian economy. So the Jordanian economy is really in the tank at this point.
Brahim, I notice in your piece, you write, the law of unintended consequences makes it even more complicated, this business of building empire. You say American unilateralism is not working as was intended by the neoconservatives in Washington. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, because what they thought, it was going to be a cakewalk in Iraq, and that the people will be welcoming them with open arms and so forth. And this didn't really happen, as evidenced by all kinds of events happening beyond the question of resistance. The question in the South, they said the Shiites would be with us, and most of the Shiites are in the South. Well, the Shiites have major demonstrations against U.S. occupation forces and against U.S. policy in Iraq, etc. And then in the North is going to be with us. Well, the Kurds in the earlier no-fly zone in the North, of course, they are with the Americans, by and large, because the American policy in terms of no-fly zone allowed them to have some kind of autonomy, the Kurds, in there. But then the Americans created this so-called Sunni triangle. So the problem with U.S. policy there, in terms of unintended consequences, really emanates primarily from their understanding of Iraq, or their misunderstanding of Iraq, I should say, which is that Iraq is divided into three zones. One is the Sunni triangle that no Iraqi ever heard of before the U.S. occupation forces got there, and then the Shiites in the south and the Kurds in the north. And if one begins to understand Iraq in terms of Shia, Sunni, and Kurds, that would be a major misunderstanding for a number of reasons. One simple reason is that there are more than three groups in Iraq. there are also Christians, and there are about 3 million, 2 to 3 million Christians, and there are another minority, which is Turkmen. And the Christians are Arab Christians, and they are also Assyrians, not Arab, but they all speak Arabic, etc., etc. So the situation in Iraq is so complicated. And in fact, the Sunni and the Shia are Arabs. And sometimes the Americans would say, like, the Kurds, the Sunnis, and the Shia, but the Kurds in their majority are Sunnis. So who are we talking about, you know? So the thing is much more complicated than Shia, Sunni, and Kurdish. And there are other kinds of dimensions in society. You know, religion and ethnicity are but two of them. See, there is also class and their immediate interests, and there are all kinds of other issues that need to be factored into the mix, the complex mix, to begin to try and understand Iraq so that you can have policies that would make sense. Again, you know, U.S., is not going to be able to make any sense of Iraq, really, and its policies would fail because it is an occupying force and is perceived by the overwhelming majority of Iraqis as an occupying force.
In listening to you talk about the division, the artificial division that the U.S. administration and the U.S. media are making, I'm reminded of the old colonial and imperial strategy of divide and conquer. And I wonder if you think that this is what's playing out here.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm sorry to say that people, quote-unquote progressive people, are falling for this. And that's why I put some emphasis on it in terms of the Sunni, Kurds, and Shia. Because we get progressive people saying something along the line of the New York Times article by Leslie Gelb saying, well, the only way to do it for the Americans is if you divide Iraq into three parts, Kurdish, Sunni, and Shia, and then declare victory and leave, you know, something of the sort, you know. But the fact of the matter, that's the wrong thing to do. But that's why, you know, it's disturbing that some quote-unquote progressives fall for that. So you wonder, you know, what the agenda of these people is. You know, as I mentioned to some people who were pushing this in here, in Hawaii, for instance, among some academics, I said, have we tried to perhaps ask the Iraqis as to what they want to do? You know, do they want to, you know, have their country divided? And how would you know that they want, you know? So someone asked me, for instance, what proof have you that Iraqis want Iraq to stay unified? So I said, what proof have we that Iraqis want their country to be divided, you know? So that's it. And from what I know about Iraq and what, you know, from what I read, et cetera, Arabic newspapers, and sometimes I listen to, you know, Arabic broadcasts, et cetera, I see no proof or any evidence that Iraqis want their country to be divided. So it is a divide and conquer tactic, and it's being pushed in a very clever way by the United States in the academy and other places to say, well, this is the way to go. If you want U.S. to leave Iraq, that's how you do it. So you make it much more problematic for Iraq to be a viable economy and a viable society if you divide it in so many pieces. You're absolutely right when you say it's a divide and conquer tactic.
Professor Alde, I have a question concerning the occupation of Iraq, because I've heard various opinions, and I think people are torn between leaving the troops or taking them out, or this idea that there might be a civil war. And I was wondering if you could tell our listeners what your views were regarding this issue.
The reality is, again, repeat them quickly, occupation. There is an occupation of Iraq by U.S. forces, and the U.S. is bogged down in Iraq. And now it's not a matter of whether should the U.S. get out or not get out of Iraq. Because they are bogged down, the U.S. is not going to get out of Iraq. That's the first thing. And even if it wanted to get out of Iraq, it's not going to be able to. You see, so they are caught between a rock and a hard place in that issue. So then the question becomes, what needs to be done? And here, in terms of, one, the Iraqi people, what the Iraqi people need to do, and apparently, it seems to me, the Iraqi people have opted for resistance. You know, Americans, you know, in the administration can say, oh, it's like Saddam and this and that and the other or Al-Qaeda or whatever. The fact of the matter, there is resistance, and the resistance, now even commanders on the ground say that mostly it is indigenous, like maybe 99% of it or 95% of it is indigenous, and that's what scares them. They are not scared of Qaeda coming in or somebody else coming in and doing resistance, but because it is indigenous, it has support of the masses. That's the first thing. The other thing is that for the American people, because we as Americans have a stake in it. Like, you know, I'm Arab-American. I'm American. You know, I live here and all that kind of stuff. And I have family here and so on. So what is important for me to do? Well, first of all, we need to build the peace movement in this country. And we need to build the peace movement so that the junta in the White House can be defeated in the next election. That's one. And so it won't go into its adventures in other parts of the world. The second thing is to show the American people that, in fact, there is a relationship between domestic politics and foreign policy, but it is not the same relationship that the U.S. administration and the junta and the White House wants us to believe it is. You know, as I mentioned, it is not like, you know, we have to do this for your security, because we can reply, well, our security is, we want to determine our security, we don't want you to determine yours, and our security is that we need better education, better health care, better jobs, jobs with a living wage, and all that, yeah? The peace movement itself would educate itself, you know, and at the same time would become a major educator of the American people in terms of politics and so forth, so that we can create a better society in this country and not to rely on the Rumsfelds and all these people who have come out of the dead, you know, because Rumsfeld was way back when from previous Republican administration like Nixon and I think Ford's. But anyway, so that's the thing that we need to do at this point. Ask the question, what is best for the American people, and build the peace movement here so that it can, in a nonviolent way, really transform this society in the interest of the overwhelming majority of the people.
You're tuned in to People's Tribune Radio. Our guest today is University of Hawaii professor Ibrahim Ayude. He has been speaking with PTR correspondent Jesus Estrada about the role of the U.S. peace movement.
Actually, Professor, that brings me to my next question. On one of your bios on the web, you indicated that the peace movement necessarily needed to address capitalism in order to succeed, and I was wondering if you could elaborate more on that.
Well, the thing is this. Why, let's not kid ourselves here. When we have like $87 billion going to Iraq now, when we have all kinds of needs here in society, that's one thing. And not to mention all the other expenses that this war had cost us, including lives. You know, American lives were lost for the sake of empire, which is not necessarily in my interest or yours unless you are a major stockholder, you know, in the New York Stock Exchange, etc. So having said that, every time, you know, in this country, you find that jobs are becoming scarcer, hourly wages are going down, and all that. Why is it? Well, it is because of this project of globalization, the process of globalization, which means basically is that major transnational corporations would be in control of the economy and of society. The values of those corporations would become pervasive in this society through like all kinds of media. Then they can have these cultural symbols, whether it is like Kentucky Fried Chicken, KFC, or McDonald's, or this or that, or this kind of song, or that song, you know. These are the values of these transnational corporations. And when they become pervasive in this world and in this society, we do not benefit from them. What happens, these come at the expense of our hourly wages, our health care benefits, our educational system, this, that, and the other. So you can see here that there is opposition between transnational corporate interests and the interests of the people. I mean, we need a better education, but we are not given better education. Well, we need better wages, living wages, housing, this, that, and the other, and we are not getting them. These gains have been rolled back over the past several years, and they're going to be rolled back even more, especially when Bush gives to the rich and takes away from the poor. In that sense, the peace movement has to have a better understanding of peace. It's not just the absence of war, but it is peace that really creates security for the overwhelming majority of our people. And that means if capitalism is in the way of this, then the peace movement of necessity will have to be anti-capitalist. And anti-capitalist means pro-human. Anti-capitalist means you are concerned for your brother and sister, for the elderly and for the children. A society that cannot take care of its children, cannot take care of its adults, should not exist, it seems to me. We should have a society that can take care of the children, can take care of the elderly, and give the adults a living wage and give them a better life so that they can take care of their own. And we all should be our brothers and sisters keepers.
You know, that raises a really interesting question, because I've been having this discussion with my students almost all semester. And usually when I bring this issue of a possibility of a cooperative society, they always question it. Is it possible to meet the needs of everyone, and who's going to pay for it? And how would you answer these students, Professor?
Well, actually, we already, in a sense, have a cooperative society at this point, but it is kind of distorted. For instance, cooperative society. No one has ever, to my knowledge, been able to pull themselves by the bootstraps all by themselves. And a cooperative society, when you are a baby, when you are born and a baby, you need cooperation to make things work. You know, your mom or your dad, or if, you know, other extended family would help out here. So we are dependent upon one another in this society. But the values of capitalism are such that the individual first, et cetera, at the expense of the community. And so what cooperative society basically means is the relationship between community and individual, and the community to advance the interests of the individual, and the individual to advance the interests of the community, and one without the other cannot exist really in any healthy, meaningful way. And that's why we have people, even in this corrupt value system of capitalism, we have people who want to help the homeless, who donate money and this and that. There is that cooperation, but the structure of society does not allow this cooperation to happen in a healthy way. So what happens then is that despite all the structural institutions, you know, or the institutions of society that are arrayed against homelessness and against the homeless, etc., what we have people who are willing to exhibit the values of a cooperative society. So can you imagine if the institutions and the structures in society are such that they are enabling of these human values that we are exhibiting on an individual level to help our brothers and sisters? You know, can you imagine how much more flowering they would be? So that's how I would answer that question.
You're tuned in to People's Tribune Radio. Correspondent Jesu Estrada has been speaking with author and University of Hawaii professor Dr. Ibrahim Ayude about the possibility of a cooperative society. Jesu Estrada now begins to find out about what kind of work Professor Ayude does with youth.
Professor, I actually wanted to backtrack all the way to kind of the beginning of the interview, and I was interested in the kinds of work you do with the youth. You mentioned a little bit, but I was wondering if you could maybe explain what happened.
Yeah, well, actually, in terms of Palestinian youth or Arab youth, it's just a matter of when I am in the area and, you know, I talk to people in the area and the region in the Middle East, and sometimes when I write things and so on. But in terms of the youth here, I mean, all these seemingly idealistic things in terms of helping our brothers and sisters and be their keepers, etc., etc., on one level, they are idealistic, but these are mostly exhibited by the youth. So what you have to do is to encourage the youth to act upon those ideals and show that these ideals are not only ideals up in the air or in somebody's imagination, that it is possible for these things to be effected. So that's what I'm talking about.
So do they do this through, like, exercises, or do they do cooperative games?
No, and I believe now that it is a question of people who have those ideas is to show them the relationship between those ideas and what's going on in society. So I do this mostly through education, talking about issues. Like, for instance, I teach a course on social movements in Hawaii. So I have them do work or a research paper on the homeless, as an example, or a research paper on a particular social movement, labor, you know, and so on. So they begin to better understand what's going on in society by going and interviewing people in labor, people who work with the homeless, etc. So you figure out what's going on, and this way you can educate people, the youth, to look at things in a larger perspective, and so these ideals that they might have would educate themselves about what needs to be done and what are the realities in terms of the homeless and labor, this, that, and the other, and then at a later stage to act upon these things, you know, later on. I don't know when later on might be. It might be like the following week. Sometimes it might take like a few months, etc.
So they're basically doing case studies of the places they've lived, like historically or presently?
Yeah, case studies, yeah. In fact, mostly I encourage them to work with people who are, you know, active currently in events like, you know, in terms of labor or homeless or housing issues and so on.
Professor, often when we do such kind of work, there's the charge that comes up is that we're teaching from a left-wing or liberal bias. And I'm wondering how you would respond to such charges.
Well, from a humanistic bias, I am biased for humanity. And whatever helps people and whatever improves their understanding of things, this is what I'm biased for. I am biased for educating the youth and people in general. And, of course, when you do research, I tell students, for instance, that you gotta just not write in terms of one point of view. You see what are the arguments or the main arguments against a point of view and try to state that argument and then support it or not support it, or, you know, support it or come against it, you see. So the idea that people are doing it only from one perspective is not true at all, except in the sense that what I'm saying, I'm biased towards humanity and I want to help people who are in need and help the youth to better understand what's going on in life. And that's it. No one is prohibited from writing in any vein, whether it's right-wing ideology or whatever. If somebody wants to make an argument, right-wing ideology argument with me for the homeless, why you shouldn't help the homeless, or I pulled myself with my bootstraps, why can't you, you know, Horatio Alger kind of argument. Let them prove it. I mean, you know, if they can prove it, then that's good. I wouldn't be against that at all. In fact, I would argue the opposite, in that every time people like the way we're talking try to do something, we are accused of exactly what you said. But I would accuse the other guys that whenever like somebody teaches in business school, they don't include the quote-unquote other side. So I would ask the other kinds of right-wing professors to also include the quote-unquote other side in their teaching. So I would come and counter-attack them with their own particular arguments.
I was wondering if you can maybe offer our listeners what your vision is of a world where everyone's needs are met, a human world.
Well, a human world, cooperative society, where people have their needs fulfilled in terms of education, healthcare, and so on, and where people can really excel in whatever they wish to do, whether it's writing poetry or building cars or sending rockets to the moon on peaceful missions, of course. And whatever it is people want to do, that they be able to do that free from want, free from need, And this way the human spirit will soar. We would be really brothers and sisters. But the way things are going now, given all the wars and atrocities and crimes on the streets and drugs and this, that, and the other, really, it's a terrible world. And we should make it a better world, and that vision would be the way to go. How do we do this? Well, building social movements, political movements that have that vision and that can act upon that vision in a way that mobilizes people to go forward and effect that vision.
Well, that concludes our interview with Dr. Ibrahim Ayude. But we're not quite through yet. We still have a commentary, written and read, by Washington State University student and League member Brett Jelinek, who joins us on the telephone from his home.
In the last year, a frenzy has swept across the American landscape, the frenzy of regime change. For neoconservative politicians, oil men, government contractors, and a misled and deceived public, regime change has meant the removal of Saddam Hussein. Others have a different idea about regime change. Progressive and conservative Democrats alike, millions of protesters worldwide, and the billions of the world's poor see the Earth's single superpower leading humanity down a dangerous path. Their campaign for regime change falls under the banner of anybody but Bush. There's a common thread that runs through each of these pushes for regime change, the idea that there is someone who poses a threat to the United States and indeed the entire planet, that we will all suffer if this person is not removed from his position of power. While regime change has not yet happened in the United States, there are important lessons to be learned from regime change in Iraq. It has become obvious that there was a lack of planning for post-war Iraq. A year since Bush declared the end of major combat, much of the infrastructure still remains ravaged. The infant mortality rate in Baghdad is twice as high now as it was in the time leading up to the war. An estimated 10,000 Iraqi civilians have died as a result of the war, keeping in mind that 40% of Iraq's population is under the age of 15. And this is in addition to the 692 coalition troops who had died by the end of February. Regardless of any good that may have come from Saddam's removal, it is lost upon the Iraqis who must fight in the streets for survival and dignity. Even supporters of the Iraq War would be hard-pressed to persuasively claim that the Bush administration had an adequate post-war strategy. The simple fact remains that innocent Iraqi civilians are suffering because of insufficient planning and preparation from our government. Bush has wreaked havoc within our own borders as well. 3 million jobs have disappeared, and nearly every state is bankrupt. The elites snatch up even more of the nation's wealth, while the middle class begins to comprehend it's standing on shaky ground. George W. Bush is quite possibly this country's worst president ever. It's time for regime change. But let's not make the mistake of past regime changes. Removing Bush will be the first step in creating a safer world, but it can't end there, or else America will fall deeper into chaos. We can't fool ourselves into thinking that Kerry is the cure we're looking for. Kerry has already announced that he will give tax breaks to corporations. We can't follow Kerry blindly, for that is what happened after September 11th with Bush, and look where that got us. What it comes down to is that there will be plenty of work still to be done after the elections, regardless of who is president. This November, be sure to go out and vote, but know that it will take more than just regime change to create a just, humane, and sane America.
PTR is brought to you by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a society where problems of injustice are solved through reorganizing society along cooperative lines. If you would like to get a copy of this program or some of our other print and media resources, you may do so by calling our 800 number, 1-800-691-6888. That number once again is 1-800-691-6888. Or visit us on the internet, and while you're there, check out our speakers bureau for your next event. The website is www.lrna.org. I'm Kenny Shook, and on behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, we hope you join us next time for People's Tribune Radio. Yeah. Check it.